Hello, I'm Eric Holdeman, and this is Disaster Zone, a podcast about emergencies and disasters. Disaster Zone will bring you interviews and commentaries about all aspects of disasters, from what causes them to how people and organizations are dealing with their impact. Today's podcast is sponsored by Ashbrit, a national rapid response emergency management and logistics company. Celebrating its 30th year, Ashbrit has led response efforts following 60 federally declared disasters across 30 states. Ashbrit is the trusted emergency management contractor for cities, counties, states, and for federal agencies. Well, welcome to the Disaster Zone podcast. With me today is Pete Gaynor. Pete and I have known one another for maybe 20 years now, and he's the former Federal Emergency Management Agency Administrator. And today we're going to be discussing how to hire people and build the staffs that you want. So welcome to the show, Pete.
Eric, it's always good to be with you.
You might be my top returning guy. This could be third time. I don't know. I definitely had you before, but yeah, for those who've never heard of Pete Gaynor,
come on.
Ask people. Yes. In your case, briefly, very briefly, share your background in leadership and again, brief summary of your leadership and hiring experiences.
Yeah. So, yes. So I think most people know me as the most recent FEMA administrator in the last administration. And I had worked in local and state government as emergency management directors and spent 26 years in the Marine Corps honing my leadership skills. So you add that all together and hopefully we'll have an interesting chat today about hiring.
All right. And I'll just say this for the military. If you're an officer, you know, you get commissioned, however that commissioning happens, and immediately you're a leader. And so it isn't like you're an analyst or doing this, that, or the other thing. My first job, I had 25 soldiers, and I was an airborne ranger infantryman, and there I was in the 17th Engineer Battalion, leading a platoon of combat engineers. So you're a leader right out of the bucket. So we'll put
that. Yeah, at least you have the label as a leader, so yeah, you are correct.
That's correct. Well, all right. I tell people, Pete, that most of my worst decisions making came when I hired people. I can think of three examples that I summarize as stinking thinking. First one is that you're thinking you're so desperate that you need someone now. So if you want somebody, really need somebody bad, that's my be what you get, somebody really bad. But the other one I call is not trusting my gut. And I've read a lot about this stuff. And where people, well, this whole trusting your gut. For Eric Holdeman, when I had questions about someone, putting too much emphasis on references and what they said about the candidate overcame my gut feeling. And boy, was I wrong on that. So, Pete, have you had any bad hiring experiences? Mistakes
and what
what did you learn from those?
Yeah, so first of all, you know, it's an imperfect system, right? I mean, you're going to make some really great hires and you're going to make some really bad hires, but I think, you know, your description about you know, those pitfalls are absolutely true, right? I think your gut says a lot, and it may be hard for you to put into words about why you don't want to hire that person to like the hiring manager or the HR people, right? They're probably not too eager to hear about your intuition on hiring. They're looking at the piece of paper that you posted. It's probably legal hiring, and you know, they want you to follow those rules and ensure that it's a legal, ethical hire. So, everyone has bad hires, but the goal is to own hiring. And this is, I think I learned like how valuable hiring was in my first job in the city of Providence. A small staff, you know, no real, you know, poor performers. But, you know, there's personnel issues along the way. There's people who quit. There's people that you have to hire. So for me, it was really a proving ground on how to understand like job descriptions, how they're written. Are they written? And I want to say both at the in the city of Providence and the state of Rhode Island, we had job descriptions that were from civil defense days. So mid 60s job descriptions that you're hiring in, you know, mid 2000s, right? Doesn't really work out well. But no one bothered to change it because it's hard to do. I also understood that, like, the value of unions. And that may sound counter to some people. But the union is the union can be if you're in a city that has a union and all that goes with that, the union can be your friend. I mean, not a friend in a friendly way, but you can work with them because and I'm going to say it for later, but I'm going to tell you how I use the union to help me with personnel problems. And it may sound counter, but I'll explain later. Okay. And I think the last part is to understand how HR departments work, right? For me, it was my first time in government. I had just came out of the military and, you know, these rules really don't apply. But it was really the proving ground to understand how it all worked.
Okay. And, you know, the intuition thing, there's an organization I used to work for now that the agency doing the hiring is taken out of the process completely, and HR does the hiring for you. And I think, okay. I'm glad I'm not there anymore. So,
yeah.
So what do you tell people today about the importance of hiring people and building a team?
So, you know, I think most of us, you know, probably you and I, we got in the business because we liked its mission, right? Helping people before, during, after disaster. It's a unique mission. It's extremely satisfying. There's always work to do to improve, like, the process of emergency management, the delivery of emergency management. But the thing that is the foundation of all that is the people that work for you, right? The people that, you know, if you got to if you're a new director and you get to a organization that has a range of talent, a range of committed employees, delivery of the mission becomes easy or becomes difficult. And I think I really learned the value of that about it's really all about people. And the agency, the organization that you lead, if you're a leader, is really a reflection of you, right? And if you let it be a reflection of someone else or some other, you know, decision maker, it's probably not going to work out well. And so for me, I made it my, you know, obviously my mission is to deliver response, recovery, mitigation, preparation, right? But my top priority was to be 100% involved in the hiring of people to my organization. You know, maybe I didn't, you know, I wasn't in on every single, you know, interview, but when it came down to the, you know, the finalists, right, I was involved. And my staff knew exactly what I wanted and exactly what I didn't want. We made it our priority. So that's one side, right? That's the hiring side. The other side is, again, if you're trying to turn around an organization, it's the accountability side that goes with that, right? Because those employees are already there. You know, hopefully most of them are doing the right thing for the right reason. There's some that are there for the wrong reason and counter to your mission, right? And morale. So there's two sides to it. But if you delegate hiring, I think you're delegating your future.
Okay. That's a good comment. And the thing about accountability, there's a false belief that you can't get rid of someone in government once they're in. And that's not true. Actually, my first big hiring mistake. I was still in the army and participated in hiring a civilian, Department of Army civilian, already in the system, took a lateral in that. And it wasn't very long. I was over to personnel office saying, okay, what do I need to do to document so this guy can move along? And I actually, that person didn't leave the army, but he left my organization. So I was happy with that. Well, there's a challenge I found in that we might hire people who think and act like us because, that's who we are. How does hiring for diversity, not only in race, but other aspects, add to the talent pool of an organization? And I think this can be hard to do because you're type A and you're looking for type A's, and that someone talks slower is a real thinker, that maybe, they don't stand out as much to you. I don't know, that type of thing.
Well, I think so. You have to be disciplined, right, about this approach. I think it was my goal. Not always possible because, I think part of the challenge for emergency management, the field is narrow. We don't do a really and so we don't do a really good job recruiting. So, if you want to change the look of and the color and diversity of your organization. You have to go actually recruit from the places that have diversity, right? If you just go to, majority white colleges and university to go recruit people, well, that's the people you're going to go hire. So you got to go to places where diversity lives, right? Black colleges and universities or
Howard
inner city
University.
universities, right? You have to go there to find those candidates because for the most part, whether you're white or black or green or blue, you probably don't know about emergency management. But so you have to sell people on the value of emergency management and the great mission it has. And then you can deliberately change the look of your organization that matches the look of your community, right? And that's really the ultimate goal. And I think, I don't, yeah, we all want A personalities, but hey, listen. There's plenty of A-type personalities that are all a rainbow of colors, right? But you have to go deliberately find those. So you have to have a mission, and you also have to make sure that, if you have a larger organization like FEMA or another larger organization where you're not going to be involved in every single hire, that the hiring HR workforce understands your priorities, right? They understand what's important to you, what's important to the organization. How we're gonna go do it. And maybe there's some rules and policy that you have to put. You gotta put them on paper, right? You gotta actually put it on paper so hiring authorities, below you in a big organization can understand what we're gonna go look for. And so don't if you delegate again, if you delegate this, then you gotta get what's handed to you. And sometimes it's not the thing that you really want. So you can do it. You have to be serious about it. But it can be done. Don't say it's impossible.
Okay. All right. And then I'm thinking about this. I was telling my wife just before we started. I see this podcast can cut both ways. It's about hiring, but there's some insights there for the people who are making applications, for a job. So how about talking about the importance of a resume and presenting yourself as a job candidate? Now, first, as a hiring person, then maybe we can throw in one of the things that concerns me is people misrepresenting themselves so much today, it appears to be. I don't know.
Yeah. So let me just tell you. So when I was a state director in Rhode Island, we had a HR platform. I want to say it was NeoGov as a brand, right? It doesn't really matter. I mean, there's other ones out there, but I thought it was a really good platform. And so, we're going to post a job for Job A, and it goes out on NeoGov and it goes out on the state website for a certain period of time, and people can submit their resumes. And so this is one job. You may have like 600 resumes that are submitted for this one job, which sounds like really great. And then you have to go through the process because the software makes you cite every single resume. 600, right? You have to go do that. I always say two-thirds, right, of that 600, like 400 that are applying for that job should never apply for that job ever, right? Your mother would say, honey, that job is not for you. And you have, and I think some of it's a result of people just looking for a job. They don't care what it is. That's one thing. I think it's a bit about technology where people can bot their resume into resume, job postings, right? And you get all sorts of resumes that make no sense about the job. And so I'm reading resumes, and the resumes to become a bread baker. That's the resume they solicit for job A in emergency management. Well, I'm not hiring a bread baker, so you're out. Again, that winnows it down to, a third left. And of the third left, right, 200. Now I'm a little bit more serious about how I look at resumes because I've winnowed it down to a more manageable number. But ultimately, it's going to come down to like the top 20, right? The top 20 resumes that are talking to you about the job that they want and the job that you posted. And then ultimately, it's going to come down to the top five. And that those top five, and you may whatever your procedure is, you may hold a over the phone interview with a couple to ask questions or all of them, right? The 20. And then it's going to come down to the top three or five. And those three or five are going to get an in-person interview. And you're gonna pick one of those. Here's a couple things. Be a good writer, right? Be clear. Have somebody else read your resume to make sure that it actually sounds correct. Spell check, grammar check. Use AI. I wouldn't really care. Use those things to your advantage because the first thing I'm looking at, right? And I'm sure you're the same way, military attention to detail, right? If you can't spell, then maybe that's, and maybe I'm looking for a way to disqualify you. Hey, he's a poor speller. Done. And it can't be that simple. So, write clearly, write briefly, write succinctly, because those things are really valuable. Spell check, use grammar check. Don't send me a resume for the baker job because I'm not hiring bakers. I'm hiring emergency managers. And again, tell your best story and tell your best story in the top third of the resume, right? Because that's what recruiters are looking at, the top third. If you can't convince them in the top third to set you aside to the next phase, then you're not making it. So focus on the top third of your resume to convince the person citing your resume that you should make it to the next level.
Now, what I tell people, and this isn't a resume podcast, is I tell them you should present what you did, kind of the scope of your position, but then have an accomplishment as part of it. It isn't just, I supervised 300 people who did this. Okay, and then because you did that, what happened? What were some of the accomplishments? And I like a functional resume more so than a chronological one, because all jobs include planning, organizing, communicating, people management, that, I don't know. And any thoughts on, chronological versus functional resume?
No, I think, and especially emergency management, because we're kind of functional anyway. We're organized functionally, like ESS are functional. So, I kind of, but again, I think you have to know who you're talking to when you submit that resume. So if you submit it to another profession that's not emergency management, maybe functional doesn't work. So you got to understand that. But I think for emergency managers, functional is good because we're looking for those specific skill sets in most jobs. Yeah, don't tell me, don't tell me the job you held, right? And the title of it. Tell me what you accomplished in that thing. How did you make a difference in the last organization you were at? Because I'm hiring you to make a difference in my organization. If you can't tell me that, then again, you're not making it through the gate.
Yeah, right. And you've kind of talked to this next one already, but I tell people, I used to coach folks on how to get hired. And I said, it's not selecting the best people. It's what you use the term winnowing out the chaff. I'd say, you take a pickup baseball, basketball game at grade school. Everybody lines up against the fence, and two people are chosen, the captains, and the captains immediately pick who the best players are because they know them. And that's not the case here. It's the exact opposite that you described. And you talked about, phone calls, oral interviews. What do you think about the process of where some places have multiple vetting, if you will? They'll have five interviews where the person is passed around through the organization and everybody gets to check them in, or lunch with the top candidate, see how they treat the waitress, and that type of thing.
I think it's, I mean, if you, I guess if you can, you have the time in your organization to do that, I guess that's what you can do. I've never worked in any of those organizations where I take top candidates to lunch. You get one shot with me, and you better impress. And I think, again, I go back to the opening here. I'm gonna bet, right? And so I've done hundreds of interview in-person interviews on, video, more video now, video interviews of candidates. And I can tell within the first 5, 10 minutes if this guy or gal is going to make it, right? Just because we prepared to ask questions. And so you can go online and you can say, if you're, I'm sure that when you're looking for a job, you're trying to study for the questions they may ask you, and you can find all those canned questions out there, and you can have canned answers. And so if you ask canned questions, right, that everyone knows that you will ask, you will get canned answers. And so you
Like
got to ask.
what's your weakness, right?
What's your weakness, right? Well, everyone knows, and I think it's kind of a dopey question to ask, because I'm just going to get a canned answer, because I've heard the answer before 100 times. Because everyone gives you the same answer, just a little version, different version of it. But I think you need to make, and this is from an emergency management public safety point of view, right? Especially in a job that high profile job or a leadership job, you gotta ask them challenging questions, about core values, questions about ethical questions, moral questions, legal questions. And I think you got to put them on the spot a little bit, right? I think these are for like big jobs. You got to put them on the spot a little bit with some scenarios to see how they react and how they answer. And you can tell those that have it ingrained in them, and those that are struggling with some of those questions. So I would just suggest have really good questions. Maybe you have to ask a couple, tell us about yourself. Okay. But I would have a couple, half of your questions are pressure questions that you're gonna test this person to make sure that you can see the true them. Because I think that's what we want to avoid, is that you hire the fake facade, and then when they show up to work, it's not the person that you hired, it's somebody else, right? So you're gonna do your best to kind of chip away at that facade by asking them questions that matter. I want to see how they think on their feet, right? Because, if I'm the fee administrator, I'm hiring an SES, a senior executive service person, who's for me is equivalent to a general or admiral across the river in the Pentagon, right? They have that level. You're going to get tested by me on with really hard questions. And then if I hire you as an SES, you represent me. So you better be able to stand up to the fire in this little fake interview we're doing. But don't ask some canned questions, because you're gonna get canned answers.
And interesting you mentioned the ethics aspect. One of the things I thought, well, maybe it's a question I have coming up, but I don't think it's here, but I know I talked about it recently somewhere, is that I think as you go up in leadership, no matter where you are, at some point your ethics will be challenged because people want something accomplished that you ethically are questioning your own mind, or there's actually a law or something. Do you agree with that assessment?
I do. Yep. I think the I think the high, so I was whether fortunate or unfortunate enough to be a political appointee for my entire local, state, federal, emergency management career so far as a political appointee. And so, there's a little bit of responsibility when it comes to that, right? I think a political appointee in public safety is a little bit easier sometimes to not cross that line, because if you cross it, then all hell breaks loose. But I think, to your point, you really have to be thoughtful and careful about crossing those moral, ethical, legal lines that will put you and most likely your organization in jeopardy, right? For me, it's a non-player. You can't do it, right? So you have to be ready, I think, especially in top level positions, to be ready to say, I'm not doing that.
Well, Pete, this has been great, but we're going to take a quick break for a message, and then we're going to be right back with more.
Today's podcast sponsor, Ashbrit, is more than an emergency management and logistics company. The company's philanthropic arm, the Ashbrit Foundation, is passionate about serving communities before, during, and after disaster events. Their foundation's mission focuses on disaster-impacted communities, vocational schools, technical training, youth education, and mental health. You can learn more at www.ashbrit.com.
And here we are back again talking with Pete Gaynor, former FEMA administrator and acting Secretary of Department of Homeland Security for a brief period there at the end of his tenure. So he's been at the highest echelons in the federal government, especially when it comes to emergency management or homeland security. So Pete, when you hire, and you've talked to this a little bit for a position, what are the major considerations in your mind as you evaluate for a particular position, or does that criteria change if at all for lower positions, or is it pretty much generic across the board? I mean, it's one is more operational and the other is more policy level. I don't know how you view that.
So just be a little clear about your question. How do I?
Well, what are some of the major considerations in your mind as you evaluate a person for a particular position? That's one. You kind of talked to that already. I don't know if you got anything to add to it.
Well, just to connect the resume to the job interview, like the in-person job interview. So, the resume is the thing that gets you to the door of the interview, right? And I'll say that, if there's three or five finalists for one job and you're going to do personal interviews, the resumes are basically even, right? The resumes got you to the in-person interview. But when I interview, in person for the final candidate, I'm not really looking at your resume anymore. I'm looking at how you fit into my organization. And honestly, I don't care. For me, it's not a diversity question, right? I mean, I think if you invested in diversity early on, then you'll solve your problem, as you go. But I want to make sure that you can reflect. I mean, listen, as the local director in Providence, as the state director in Rhode Island, and as the field administrator, I mean, I'm in charge of the organization, and the organization reflects me, right? So I want to make sure that the person I hire, especially when it comes to senior executive service, they reflect the things that I think are important, right? They reflect my belief system. They reflect the things I believe in, about ethics, integrity, all those things. You need to like show me that you and I have the same. I'm not saying 100%. I'm just saying that you and I have these same core values about how we approach life, which impacts, how you approach the job and how you lead. That is ultimately in the final minutes of a hire. Again, back to your original thing, I'm hiring on gut. Like I like that guy, or I like that gal, or I don't like that guy, and here's why I don't like him. And this is why I'm not hiring him. And I've had arguments at all levels of government about who I wanted to hire and who I didn't want to hire with my staff who were involved in some of these decisions. But ultimately, it's, you know, if you're the leader of the organization, you're responsible for that hire, right? So I'm okay making that decision, but that person needs to reflect who you are and what you're trying to build inside that organization, right? Because once you hire them, you own them.
Yeah. So two things you talked about there. One, I'd always end a staff meeting with telling myself, go forth and do good things. Well, you got to be sure they know what good things are. know, what's good things? I mean, maybe that's setting expectations too, but good things, you know, could entail a lot of different aspects.
And so, Eric, I'm just thinking about some of the people that surrounded me, especially at FEMA. And you know, it's all different, you know, different levels of trust, and you know how you delegate responsibilities and who owns what. But there was a big group of people that I intuitively trusted 100%. Right, if they said it was going to happen, or I said it needed to happen, and they said that they're going to make it happen, I took them for their word, right? I'm not going to micromanage on the end, because I trusted them implicitly, right? And I think that's part of the magic here, is that you can't do everything. You need good people that you can trust. And there's another group of people that maybe I didn't trust so much. Not that they were a bad employee, but maybe, you know, I needed to have a little bit more care and feeding and attention on them, because you know, maybe they were young and they just needed it, right? So again, I think it's important because the people that are around you are the people that are going to make it happen for you.
Yeah, the other thing I told my daughter several times, she's a leader now, manager, senior manager, and I said, your job as leader is provide the guidance, strategy and resources, so that you know people can go for, you know, they're not waiting to be told what to do. They got your world picture of what needs to be done, and then they go execute it on your behalf. And I would say, find a good organization, you'll find a good leader.
I agree.
Well, do you think all those things applied? You know, we're kind of talking the policy level, and you're at the senior level in that. But does the criteria change at all for lower level positions? You know, so where
no,
they're
no,
you know, they got fingers no, on I, the keyboard, and you know.
I mean, you know, in a big organization like FEMA, you know, I would tell you that I'm involved in 99% of SES hires, because that was my mandate. I want to know what generals that I'm hiring, because the generals and the admirals are the ones I'm going to war with. So I need to know who they are, and I need to know that, you know, I can trust them. And so when it comes to, you know, lower level hires, right, there are some, because it's a particular position that I'm interested in, right? Maybe a GS-15 position. Maybe I'm involved in that because it's a unique position that I have an interest in. And then the rest of it is, you know, the machine is hiring them, but there's people that make up that machine. And, you know, through your HR head, you know, at FEMA, we had mission support that kind of sees all that. You know, I was pretty clear about what I wanted when we hired, right? Now, is it 100%? Probably not, but I try to make it as clear as I could about who we're hiring and why, right? And again, it was my pet peeve. It's all about recruiting, right? If you want to change diversity, you got to go to you got to go where the diversity lives. So don't complain to me about we only have too many white guys here. Where did you go recruit them? Well, we went to the white universities. Well, there you go. There's your problem. So. Right. Everyone owns this, and you have to hold them accountable to get there. And, okay. and they report it. They report it on it. You know, every quarter, like, where are we on diversity hires?
Okay. Well, before we hit record, we had a brief discussion. I mentioned the probationary period and how because of previous mistakes on my part, I learned to value the probationary period. I don't know whether it's a probationary period for SES positions, as you describe, or not, but any thoughts on that aspect of the hiring process? Yeah, you got hired, but there's a period of time where all of a sudden you figure out, this isn't working as a hiring authority.
Yeah, I'm going to answer this question, but and I wanted to tell you a story about how my mindset changed on this early in my career, and I just don't want to leave the audience without that story. So just remind me. So listen, if your HR infrastructure has probationary built into it, then you should use it, because first of all, I think the human nature is, hey, we hired the guy and I really don't want to fire him because you know he's been here 11 months and he's okay. But that's the weak way out. If you have a probationary period, you need to use it to your advantage. And why would you keep if you have the opportunity to ask somebody to leave because they're not working out, you know, and you have that ability to do it, you know, why would you not want to use that? I mean, to me, it's just illogical to say, oh, we're going to suffer because we don't have the moral courage.
That's right.
Sunset is here for you there, buddy. Yeah. But you got to do it. And with that, you have to document, right? You got to document this whole thing. And that's a commitment, whether they're on probation or they're just an employee that's been there for 20 years that is not cutting the mustard anymore. If you don't document it, you will live with it like a yoke around your neck, right? You can, as a manager, as a leader, you have the ability to change the complexion. Now, I'm not talking about diversity complexion, but to change the complexion of your organization by accountability and rewards, right? You can do that, but it all takes documentation, right? If you're not documenting it, you might as well just wait. You're wasting your time.
Right. And I'll tell my one story. It's we had a new plan need to be written, brand new. So we're not updating. It's a blank sheet of paper, and I hired someone. And you know, it takes a while to get a brand new thing started. What's it going to look like? What's the entities in it? Who are going to involve in the planning? All that. It was a 6-month probationary period, and that came and went. And then I had the yoke on my neck with that particular individual. And I went back to HR and said, okay, for these senior analyst positions, we call them planners, it needs to be 12 months because it takes a while to figure out sometimes, is this person really a good fit and that. So I went with 12 months back then. All right, you said you had a story.
Yeah, so I want to tell two stories. So the other part of this is partnering with the union. And the short story to this is many believe that, you know, management and the union is at odds all the time. And that may be true on some things. And I'll say when I got to the state of Rhode Island, I think I had like 35 employees, and I probably had 5 employees that were troublemakers, long term. They had been there for years, long term troublemakers, and you know, some like troublemakers, like, you know, troublemakers, and others just kind of you know, just doing the bare minimum, not getting by, failing at every turn. And you know, I committed to get rid of them because they were a morale drag to everyone else that was doing a great job.
Yeah, and just a quote on that: all the good people are waiting for you to do something.
They are, and the people that are on the edge, do I go to the right side or the dark side, are worrying. So you have an obligation to get rid of those people. So we made a commitment to do that, and so I invited the union to help me through this thing, right? And this is the great part of the story is at the end, there's one particular individual that we had been, you know, going through the whole legal process, you know, documenting and you know, how do you improve? Didn't do it. The union manager came to me one day and said, listen, we're declaring this person a administrative burden on the union. And we're not, so this is the union person telling me, we're not giving him any more legal help or any more administrative help, he's on his own. And that was like to me, that was like, oh my goodness, we
yeah, well, that's a partner. Their partner.
So, but this is the beauty of the union. They don't want bad employees either. They don't yeah. want it. They want good employees. So find that common ground. If you have a union, you can work, you know, you can't conspire together, right? Because they have legal obligations, but you can work together to get rid of these people that are troublemakers. So it can be done. So here's the thing I think that was profound to me when I first got to as a state director in Rhode Island. So the governor at the time, new governor at the time, Gina Raimondo, she's the commerce secretary now. So the emergency management director was in the cabinet. And this is her first cabinet meeting with, like, in the first week she took office. And she had some priorities that she wanted to do. And one of them was she wanted to have state employees more accountable to the citizens, right? It was kind of a lofty goal about how do we keep our, or how do we instill in our employees to be more accountable to the taxpayer. And so she kind of laid out the 50,000 foot view of what her goal was, right? This is how I want to see it go. And then she left the room and she turned it over to her, and I'm not going to give any names, but she turned it over to one of her trusted staff members who had been in government for a while. And he gave an hour's worth of graduate level instruction about how to, within the system that you live, within the system that a state employee lives, how to get rid of problematic people according to the rules. Here's all the rules. And he, because, you know, everyone in the room, all the cabinet members, they're all probably brand new. They haven't probably been in government. So they really didn't have a basis to kind of understand how the state government works. It was my first time in state government, and I didn't really understand how it works. But he took an hour and laid out, here's how it all goes, to include how do you reward somebody, and here's how we're going to award somebody, right? So it was balanced. It was we're going to get rid of the people that don't cut it, and we're going to reward the really great people so we can attract better people. But I would say, you know, if you don't understand how your government runs, if you're in, you know, local, state, or federal service, you don't understand how it runs when it comes to people. You have to get an education on that. Because if you don't know the rules, right, you can't play the game.
Right. Okay. Great example of there are rules in baseball and in government that can help or
absolutely.
Yeah. So one last question about hiring, and this is again. A lot of times you don't get to pick the team that you have. It's kind of you're dealt the cards you got when you walk in, and you pick them up off the table, and those are the people you play with. But how is it? Because we see these people in senior positions and then they have feet of clay. And a lot of times I think it's a character issue overall. Why does it take so long? They've been in the system for a long time. They get to a senior position. I don't know whether they abuse their authority or abuse their, for lack of a better word, power. And it wasn't a good fit to be in a leadership position. What's your thought on that? How did they get there and seem totally so, corrupt many times? But.
Yeah. So, you know what? It's like you don't wake up today and decide to become a bank robber. You know what I mean? It just doesn't happen that way. You know, if you're robbing a bank today, you were probably stealing from people your entire life, right? In some form or fashion. You don't wake up as a bank robber. And so I think if you like did forensics on a person who, had a feet of clay or didn't live up to the job or got promoted by, because maybe that was the last guy standing there, last gal standing there. It's a long trail, I think, right? You could pick out all the micro failures along the way. And I think it's like institutional sometimes, because sometimes is it easier to fire the guy or is it easier to pass the problem off to somebody else, right? I can just easily transfer that person, vice, having to do this whole HR, administrative, corrective action thing that's going to take me another year to show results, or I can go put them on a detail, right? Or TAD, or whatever you want to call it. I'm going to go transfer them out of my hair.
And all then, right, we're acronym free. Used one, I don't know. What was that? CAE or whatever that is?
Oh, no, TAD, temporary duty assignment, right? In the military. Okay.
Yeah,
but I think that's part of the problem. It's really about lack of accountability early on, right? If you don't have it, some of those people will find their way to the top, and then everyone's surprised about how they got there. Listen. There's no surprise, right?
Yeah.
You could go back in time and ask that guy or gal's peers about their performance, and they'd give you the same sorry answer about what they were doing or not doing.
Yeah. Okay, so I said some of this would be applicable to somebody getting hired, but you've got to be at conferences and different events, you know, in the hallway or something, and this bright, shiny emergency manager wannabe is in college and getting a degree, walks up and says, what advice do you have for me for finding a position in emergency management? What's your 30-second hallway response to
that? Well, I go back to my premise. It's a narrow industry, right? It's not that wide. And in some cases, it's just hard to get into because there's not a lot of it. So my first thing would be go volunteer somewhere, go be an intern, go do something for free. And I know that's hard to do sometimes because everyone wants to get paid, but in some cases it may be the fastest way in to where you want to get. The other part of it is maybe you take the job, you take a job that is not the perfect job for you, right? Because everyone wants to, you know, be in that perfect job, but maybe the job next to that job or two jobs over from that job is a good place to start, because at least, right, you've got your foot in the door and now you can see how the organization operates. You can see what opportunities are there. You can network, you can make friends, you can hone your skills, you know, if you had a skill issue. So don't say no to the imperfect job, right? So I think you need to do that. And again, I think it gets you in the door. And then lastly it goes back to writing, you know, have your mother or girlfriend or boyfriend read the resume, right? Don't leave it to chance that resume is well written. And again, if you can't convince me in the top third, then you've lost an opportunity. And then my last thing is for an interview, right? For like an in-person interview, whether it's online, right? Like we are now. I actually had a t-shirt on this morning. I took my t-shirt off and I put a collared shirt and a sweater on to talk to you, Eric, right? Yeah. I didn't want to be in my work wear today talking to you. So I don't have a tie on, but I'm a little, right? So when you have an interview, put a coat and a tie on, right? Or appropriate dress for females. Put like dress for the job that you want. Don't show up in a burlap sack or wrinkled clothes or no tie or no haircut, right? And now people may be saying those old farts just can't get into the, you know, the new way of things, but it counts for a lot because I'm hiring you to be represent my agency. And my agency, I want it to look and feel a certain way. I'm not hiring an auto mechanic in dungarees. I'm not hiring that guy. I'm hiring a guy or a gal that, you know, I'm going to put out in some cases in front of the public or next to the governor or next to the mayor. That's the guy I'm hiring. So take it seriously. Dress up. Get your hair cut. Have your mother read your resume, right? Just don't write it. And here's my other thing. If you get an interview, if you haven't researched the agency or organization that you're interviewing with, you're lazy. Right. Go research the agency. You should know more about the agency than the person interview you. And I guarantee if you did a little bit of research, you will know more. And then have a challenging question for the interviewer. I love this. Right now, you don't want to be disrespectful. You don't want to be a smart ass. But if you ask a really good question that maybe rocks the interview her back in his or her chair a little bit, guess who they're going to remember? They're going to remember you. Hey, that guy that asked that real, that gal that asked that really great question. Who is that person again? Let's take another look at him, right? Or her. So don't sit there like a fish, right? Answering the canned questions. Be ready to like make an impression. So
how about Mr. Administrator, what role, if any, do you think FEMA should be playing in the border crisis along our southern border? Whatever. I'm not saying you got to answer that, but I mean that.
No, but I mean, yeah, again, you know, you're not, but I would just say prepare a really good question, a thoughtful question, insightful question, because when they're looking through this, when they have the pitches of the candidates and they're looking through the final resumes, they're going to remember you, right? Yeah. They're going to remember you for the right reason. So, you know, go in there loaded, right? Go loaded to win.
Yeah. And the other tip I tell a lot of emergency management wannabes is be willing to move. You know, there are jobs out there. And if you have a girlfriend, boyfriend, blah, 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 okay, then hang around where you are and wait for the local director to have a heart attack, retire, get fired. But then you're still going to have to compete for that position too. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, Pete, really switching gears here. You've focused your time most recently on preparing people to lead in a crisis. Tell us a little bit about those efforts and how people can plug in and get more information.
Yeah. Thanks, Eric. So after I left Washington, D.C., which was put some joy into my heart when I left, I spent some time reflecting about my experiences as the FEMA administrator and the secretary, acting secretary of Homeland Security. During a really unique time in our nation's history. And it took me about a year. And what I really wanted to do, the why of why I wanted to do this, is I wanted to share my experiences in leadership positions with others that will be there someday, right? So I'm trying to share what I've learned as the FEMA administrator with those leaders out there that are young or still in the business, to give them the tools they need to really prepare for the next big thing, right? I think part of the deficit that we have is, it's hard to get real world experience, right? I mean, if you live in Florida and Texas and Louisiana, you're getting some real world experience, but that's a small part of the country. And, you know, emergencies are emergencies, right? And I don't want to discount that, but, you know, they happen every day. You know, my focus on leading during crisis is to provide you like high level tools to make you successful on that unthinkable day. So I really want my goal is really to share that with my peers out there, both new and old. And you can find that at at the White House, they used to call me FEMA Pete. So I have FEMAPete.com and you can. I have two versions of it. I've done it in person a number of times to small groups. Or you can buy the online version. There's a couple different versions you can buy, and take that that course, you know, at the comfort of your own desk. So leading during crisis, www.femapete.com.
Okay, all right. And my nickname at that engineer battalion was Pete the pickaxe. somebody gave it to me. So there you go. So
everyone asks you how you got that nickname, because everyone is a reason why you got that nickname.
I don't know. I'll tell you this. I had a number of nicknames in the military. One was Preacher.
Yeah.
My favorite was Bubbles. That was one of my nicknames. So my effervescent personality, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. I'll share. I only had really one nickname, and it was a result I did not personally crash this vehicle. I was the commander in the vehicle that crashed.
Mm-hmm.
So in
the military, the commander is responsible, by the way. Okay.
Yes. So my nickname was Crusher.
Okay.
which actually is pretty good, right? Compared to Bubbles, right? It's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, you know. I'm a kinder, softer guy. Anyway, hey, I want to say thank you to Pete Gaynor for being a guest here on the Disaster Zone podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Eric, for inviting me today.
Okay. And, you know, really, Pete, he emphasized hiring people as a danger zone and not a disaster zone, hopefully. When it comes to adding staff, the importance of selecting the best people has never been greater. Hopefully you picked up a few tips to help your own hiring processes. And lastly, a reminder to everyone to be safe. Think about what you can do today to become personally better prepared for the next disaster. If you like this Disaster Zone podcast with the Crusher, please share it with your social media contacts. Thanks for listening and be safe.
Tune in again soon for more information on all aspects of disasters. You can also check out the Disaster Zone blog at www.disaster-zone.com.